Genesis chapter 37, announcement, potluck supper, next Sunday evening, immediately after class, March 18. Tonight, we're ready to finish out chapter 37. And we did at 10 o'clock chapter 38, so we'll move to 39 and spend, I think, the rest of our time simply getting an introduction to that very important chapter in the life of Joseph. We had first Joseph hated because of his dreams in verses 1 through 11, and now we have him sent 12 through 17, and then we will have him sold into Egypt. First of all, he is sent, and his commission comes to verse 12. Then his brothers went to pasture their father's flock in Shechem. And Israel, he will be called that now interchangeably with Jacob. Israel, or Jacob, said to Joseph, "Are not your brothers pasturing the flock in Shechem? Come, I will send you to them." And he said to him, "I will go." Notice, first of all, the perfect willingness of Jacob to send Joseph and of Joseph's willingness to go. So we ought to note something here. Both men seem to be either ignorant or naive about the brothers' hostility. Both seem to be naive about the hostility of the brothers. Wouldn't you think that since as soon as they see Joseph coming, they prepare to kill him, that Jacob wouldn't have known that, or Joseph wouldn't have known that? So we can go one of two roads here. We can either say that they were naive about the hostility, or you can take another turn in the road. It may reveal something about jealousy. And it would be this, then. Jealousy, even willingness to kill out of jealousy. Jealousy may lie hidden and unsuspected. Jealousy may lie hidden and totally unsuspected. And I would imagine that that is probably the point. Probably not so much that Jacob and Joseph are naive, but they're naive about jealousy, is that jealousy can put on a nice front, it can have a nice cover, but on the inside, as two parties shake hands in apparent friendship, one party is so jealous of the other that they're ready and willing when the opportunity comes to kill them. And that seems to be the case that we've got here with Joseph and with Jacob and the brothers. It seems like they're going to anticipate that Isaac is going to be welcomed, but are naive about the depth of the hostility that is there. Notice also, coming down now to verse 14, then he said to him, Jacob to Joseph, "Go now, see about the welfare of your brothers and the welfare of the flock, and bring word back to me." So he sent him from the valley of Hebron, and he came to Shechem. Notice the reliability of Joseph is assumed. The reliability, the trustworthiness of Joseph is assumed. He knew that when Joseph went, he would bring back an honest report. That's probably based on precedent. Remember back in verse 2, Joseph was 17 years of age, pasturing the flock with his brothers while he was still a youth, along with the sons of Bilhah, the sons of Zilpah, their father's wives, and Joseph brought back a bad report about them to their father. So the reliability is assumed based on precedent. I know that Joseph will bring back a good report because he's done it before. So again, remarkable, by age 17, Joseph has already established himself at that age as dependable and reliable, and his father has no hesitant about his sending him to the brothers to check on their welfare. Now, there is a link between the word welfare in this verse and the word found in verse 4. Verse 4 says, his brothers saw that their father loved him more than all his brothers, so they hated him and could not speak to him on friendly terms. And as you look at those two expressions, friendly terms and the word welfare, you would never guess that they translate the same Hebrew word. They translate the same Hebrew word, shalom. So that when we read verse 4:37 says, his brothers saw that their father loved him more than all his brothers, so they hated him and could not speak to him, saying, shalom. They could not say shalom to Joseph. When you come down, however, to verse 14, Joseph is commissioned by his father, and he's to go and see about the shalom of your brothers and the shalom of the flock. So the interesting thing there is this. Joseph's mental attitude was this. I can shalom my brothers. But the brothers had a mental attitude that could not shalom David, Joseph. They could not say that to him. And what is the difference between Joseph's ability to say shalom and their inability to say shalom? What's the difference? Green monster, jealousy, made the difference between the two. Well, as soon as he is sent, he engages in a search, chapter 37, verse 14b, last sentence of the verse. So he sent him from the valley of Hebron, and he came to Shechem. And a man found him. Behold, he was wandering in the field, and the man asked him, what are you looking for? And he said, I'm looking for my brothers. Please tell me where they're pasturing the flock. Now, when you look at that little piece of information, the thing you want to ask is, what is that there for? Why do we need a notation that Joseph was out wandering around in a field, and a man said, what are you looking for? And he said, his brothers, and he pointed them in the in the right direction. Why are we given that bit of information? Well, I think the reason is perhaps twofold. Number one, it underscores how undependable the brothers were. They weren't where they were supposed to be. They were supposed to be in Shechem. They weren't there. And therefore, the dependability of Joseph is side by side with the undependability of the brothers. The dependability of Joseph is underscored by an emphatic word in verse 16. The emphatic word is the direct object, brothers. So they say, what are you looking for? And he said, my brothers is what I'm looking for. In other words, it would be Joseph's way of saying, I'm here to do what I was sent to do. My father sent me to find my brothers, and that's what I'm here for. I'm looking for my brothers. So his dependability is underscored. He's simply saying, I'm out here doing just exactly what my father sent me to do. So Joseph was not only faithful, but by his consistent search, he was faithful and he was persistent. All right? With him sent now to the brothers, we now have Joseph sold. Sent and now sold. 18 through 30. And the proposal of his brothers is threefold. First, you have this proposal. Let us kill him. And let us kill him is found in verses 18 through 20. Verse 18. When they saw him from a distance, and before he came close to them, they plotted against him to put him to death. And they said to one another, here comes the dreamer. Now then, come, let us kill him. So the first proposal is the death of Joseph. The important thing that comes in to the passage at this point is the extreme actions of jealousy. Jealousy and envy was so strong. Jealousy moved them to do two things. Number one, jealousy moved to kill their own brother. flesh and blood brother. Shows the powerful driving force that jealousy can have. And finally, they're not only driven by jealousy to kill their brother, but they're driven by jealousy to deceive their father. Now, notice in the remark made beginning in verse 19 and extending through verse 20, is the whole statement is bracketed by reference to Joseph's dreams. Notice 19, here comes the dreamer. And it ends up in verse 20, let us see what will become of his dreams. So the initial and the end of the plan shows the tremendous contempt they have for Joseph's dreams. Now that would also, look at it from Joseph's standpoint, this would also be a test for Joseph, wouldn't it? In his dreams, he was to become supreme and become ruler. And in this context, he's going to be severely tested, because in this verse, Joseph, your dreams that God has given you about supremacy are about to come to an end, because you're going to be dead and your dream will not be fulfilled. The other thing that would cause him to despair of his future was the man that is to rule his brothers gets sold by his brothers. Notice verse 27. Come, let us sell him. This is the one to whom God has given the dream that you're going to rule and you're going to reign, is now getting sold. Can you imagine what Joseph felt? Can you imagine that he did not sit down and say, well, the dream that God had given me about my future, it's all off. Here I am being sold, and God had promised me in the dream that I was to rule. So it's a test for him. Is it unlike God to make a promise and then make every circumstance say that promise will never be fulfilled? Is this unusual? God does it every time. Made a promise to Abraham that he would have a seed like the stars of the heaven, and Sarah's childless. And you look at all the circumstances that come along, and everything is there. So the sequence is usually God makes a promise. The man believes it. And then God begins to bring all these circumstances that say the promise will never be fulfilled. Same thing with Abraham that is true with Joseph. Joseph is promised a great future, and you come down to verse 28, it involves rulership and reign and authority and supremacy, and then some Midianite traders passed by, so they pulled up Joseph, lifted him out of the pit, and they sold him. There is the one that's going to reign. There's the one to whom the sheaves of grain had bowed down. There's the one that the sun, moon, and stars were doing obeisance to. And therefore, Joseph is facing a very, very personal test. He was to rule, and yet he is sold. Well, Reuben comes along, kind Reuben, and says, let's not kill him. Let's throw him in this pit. Let's throw him in the pit. And that is found narrated in verses 25 or verses 21 through 24. Verse 21, then Reuben heard this and rescued him out of their hands and said, let us not take his life. Reuben further said to them, shed no blood. Here's his proposal. Throw him into this pit. The pit would simply be a place dug out to collect rain for the watering of the flocks at different scattered places in the wilderness. And apparently it was a very dry season. This one was dry. And the idea is, let's throw him into the pit, but don't kill him. And he did this because he wanted to rescue him, the latter part of verse 22. Along comes Judah as they are eating. By the way, notice when they throw him in the pit that jealousy has no conscience whatsoever. They throw him in the pit, verse 23, 24. They strip him of his tunic. And they took him and threw him into the pit. The pit was empty without any water in it. And notice how casually they sat down to eat a meal. It's sort of like shooting your brother and then going out for pizza and enjoying it. And this, again, is a feature of envy. Envy has no conscience. So the third proposal comes from Judah, and that is, let us sell him. You know, look at all these things that happened to Joseph, and can't you imagine, this guy had every external circumstance to drive him out of his mind. I mean, being sold, being thrown in a pit, and they really want to kill him. All of this happening to Joseph. Joseph is never, to our knowledge, disturbed about anything that ever happens to him. And no one really has anything happen to him it's all, from the human standpoint, it is all very bad. The only remark we do have is later on, the brothers do make comment that we didn't listen to the cries of Joseph when we sold him. So while there are no words of Joseph in chapter 37, apparently he did plead with these brothers to be released. All right, chapter 37 now, the proposal of Judah, let's sell him, coming down to verse 28. The Midianite traders passed by, so they pulled him up and lift Joseph out of the pit, and they sold him to the Ishmaelites for 20 shekels of silver. And here is the climactic point. Here is how Joseph got to Egypt. Thus, they brought Joseph to Egypt. And there, with the end of that verse, we are told how he arrived at this place. The last sentence of verse 28 wraps up the human history of how Joseph got to Egypt. Now, we need to keep in mind, however, and it might be well to put it here, that the words, thus they brought Joseph into Egypt, the word thus looks purely at the human cause. But these words that end verse 28 are given a theological interpretation. And the theological interpretation, or the doctrinal interpretation, of the words, they brought Joseph into Egypt, is found in chapter 45. Chapter 45 is the theological interpretation of chapter 37. So let's put down, for the sake of memory, that Genesis 45, 4 through 8, is the theological interpretation. Genesis 45, 4 through 8, is the theological interpretation of Genesis 37, 18 through 36. It's very important to note that we have the selling, we have the envy, we have the bartering, we have the manipulation, we have the hatred, we have the ridicule of Joseph, all of those things come into the picture, but this all has theological interpretation, and that is Genesis 45, verse 4. The interpretation given here is the interpretation that Joseph took of the whole affair. And it is, I'm sure, what saved his sanity and why he could become a great leader. Verse 4, then Joseph said to his brothers, please come closer to me. And they came closer. And he said, I'm your brother Joseph, whom you sold into Egypt. And of course, they knew all about that. And now do not be grieved or angry with yourselves because you sold me here. And now we make a quantum leap forward to the theological interpretation. For God sent me before you to preserve life. For the famine has been in the land these 2 years. There are still 5 years in which there will be neither plowing or harvesting. And God sent me before you to preserve for you a remnant in the earth and to keep you alive by a great deliverance. Now, therefore, it was not you who sent me here, but God. And that is the key to Joseph's viewpoint on life. We have called it Romans 8:28 mentality. It's Joseph able to look back and say, guys, the issue is not what you did to me. That's not even the point. Granted you sold me. Granted you're envious. Granted you did all of these things. Granted you wanted to kill me. But that, in my mind, is no issue whatsoever. The issue in my mind is doctrine. And the doctrine is the sovereignty of God, and this is the way he views it. Okay, final section of chapter 37 is Jacob deceived. 29-36. And we'll break this down into the deception and the grief. First, the deception, 29-32. Now what you have in these verses is another instance of talionic justice, or we often call it poetic justice, which means what you did to another person is what comes back on your own head. You deceived, you'll be deceived. You lied to them, you will become the victim of a lie. You stole from them, you will be stolen from. And we have a good example of that now in chapter 37, closing out down to verse 29. Reading. Now Reuben returned to the pit, and behold, Joseph was not in the pit, so he tore his garments. I don't know where Reuben was when they made the deal to sell, but apparently all somewhere. So he took, and he returned to his brothers and said, "The boy is not there. As for me, where am I to go?" So they took Joseph's tunic, slaughtered a male goat, and dipped the tunic in the blood. And they sent the very colored tunic and brought it to their father and said, "We found this. Please examine it to see whether it is your son's tunic or not." Then he examined it and said, "It is my son's tunic. A wild beast has devoured him. Joseph has surely been torn to pieces." So notice the poetic justice is this. He stands there with that garment that had been soaked in the blood of a goat, and he was fooled. Do you remember when Jacob did that? Go back to chapter 27. Here he is fooled about the death of his son by a garment dipped in the blood of a goat. And remember when Jacob himself had pulled the goat trick on his father, Isaac? Chapter 27 of Genesis, verse 16. He's getting prepared to deceive his father, and Jacob answered his mother Rebekah, Behold, Esau, my brother, is a hairy man, and I am a smooth man." And so she makes the proposal, and you come down to verse 16, it says, "She put skins of the kids on his hands," or the goats, "on his hands and on the smooth part of his neck. He fooled his father with a goat." Verse 21, "Then Isaac said to Jacob, 'Please come close, that I may feel you, my son, whether you're really my son Esau or not.'" And verse 23, "He did not recognize him because his hands were hairy like his brother's, Esau's hands, and so he blessed him." And so Jacob, with a goat, deceived his father. And now, Jacob is deceived with a goat was slain, and its blood was placed on the tunic was dipped in its blood. So the same thing is coming along over here in chapter 37, verse 33, while he recognizes it, and he says he will mourn his son to the grave. And that simply says this: the fruit of deception is deception. To deceive another is to bring deception on yourself. Another principle is also involved here with the deception of Jacob, and I think you can establish it throughout Scripture. It's difficult, if not impossible, to commit one sin. You always have to commit a chain. And so they commit the sin of selling Joseph, But the sin of selling Joseph calls for another one. Now they've got to deceive Jacob. I remember someone saying, I don't know, a number of years ago that's since moved from here, said when I became a Christian, some of the business practices that I had been engaged in was based on telling lies. And he says, it's so wonderful to meet someone now and not to have to try to remember what was the last lie that I told him and try to talk in accord with what you told him. He says, it's so nice just to tell the truth. And this is the case here. They sin once, and this is a chain. They could not merely dispose of Joseph. They had to deceive their father also. So let's put under the deception, it was necessitated by a prior sin. You always have to commit two sins. You can't ever commit one. You commit one, and then you have to cover it. So you have to be dishonest, and you have to follow up a sin with another sin. And this is exactly what happens in this context. This is followed by a statement of grief. Finishes out the chapter. Verse 34, it says, so Jacob tore his clothes, put sackcloth on his loins, and mourned for his son many days. This is the low point in the life of Joseph. Thankfully, from this point, everything is up. From here on will be elevation and so forth. But notice, how could they do that to their father? We stated the principle already. Jealousy has no conscience. They could do a horrible thing because they were the victims of jealousy, or they allowed jealousy and envy to enter in. It's also interesting that they sold him into Egypt, and that in the attempt to prevent the fulfillment of Joseph's dream, they become the instruments to fulfill Joseph's dream. Again, the Romans 8:28 concept. Now, since we have covered chapter 38, let's go over now to chapter 39. And basically, I want to just simply itemize things that we need to look at coming into chapter 39, where we have Joseph in temptation. First of all, 39:1 picks up where chapter 37 left off. 39:1 picks up where chapter 37 stopped. Notice how chapter 39 and verse 1 is sort of a review. Now Joseph had been taken down to Egypt. See, he's picking up the thread because he's interrupted with the incident involving Judah and Tamar in chapter 38, with which Joseph had nothing to do. He's not even in the chapter. We simply leave him down in Egypt in 37, and we're now looking at 39 that picks up the history and relates it to us again. So that we've got this. 37 tells us how Joseph arrived in Egypt. And as soon as it tells us that, it breaks off, and we have the incident of chapter 38. Chapter 39 tells us how Joseph advanced in Egypt. 37, how he arrived, then an interruption about how he was advanced in Egypt that goes from chapter 39 on to the end, up through chapter 41. Joseph's advancement is seen in three phases. Chapter 39, 40, and 41. By chapter 42, he has advanced to the place of prime minister. So Joseph's rise or advancement is in 39, 40, and 41. the first, and think of these as scenes. The first scene is in Potiphar's house. From Potiphar's house, we move to prison. And from prison, he moves to the palace of the Pharaoh. So scene 1, 39, 1 through 23, Potiphar's house, reading verses 3 and 4 just to get the picture. His master saw that the Lord was with him, how the Lord caused all that he did to prosper in his hand. So Joseph found favor in his sight and became his personal servant. And he made him overseer over his house. And all that he owned he put in his charge. That is the first scene. Joseph functioning in the house of Potiphar. The second scene is prison. And that is in chapter 40. And then the third scene in chapter 41 is where Pharaoh has a dream and Joseph interprets the dream and he is elevated to the place of prime minister. So here is the threefold advancement that we'll be looking at in this section. Second, and by way of introduction, what are some of the doctrinal ideas? What are some of the doctrinal concepts found in these verses? Number one, and these are really bring us into reality. Number one, faithfulness to God. Faithfulness to God does not exempt the believer from the possibility of false accusation and unjust treatment. Faithfulness to God does not exempt a believer from the possibility of unfair treatment, unjust treatment. Joseph, in chapter 39, did the right thing, and things got much worse. I repeat, Joseph did the right thing in chapter 39, and as a result of doing the right thing, everything got worse. And that's a reality we need to face because we tend to think that God is up there in heaven and says, well, you really play it fair, don't you? You really were faithful to me. You really did the right thing. I'm not going to allow you to be slandered. No such promise. Joseph did the right thing and things got much, much worse. Faithfulness to God does not exempt nor guarantee or obligate God in any way to exempt us from unfair treatment. Second, and this is simply an observation, notice that the great temptation came when Joseph was being greatly blessed by God. Temptation came while being richly blessed by God. The blessing of God in one's life does not mean in the midst of that wonderful blessing you're not going to run head on into temptation. It happened to Joseph. Now let's see that context. The temptation pertains to the wife of Potiphar. And you notice in verse 2, the Lord was with Joseph. And as the Lord was with Joseph, Joseph walked right into very deep temptation. Verse 5, and it came about from time to time, from that time he made him overseer of his house and over all that he owned, and the Lord blessed the Egyptian's house. Verse 21, the Lord was with Joseph, and verse 23 says, the jailer did not supervise anything under Joseph's charge because the Lord was with him, and whatever he did, the Lord made to prosper. And there is the principle. Temptation came while being richly blessed. Question, are we most vulnerable in prosperity or in suffering? And I'll put that as a think-through question. Are we most vulnerable when in prosperity or when in suffering? Third observation, and this is an important one to make, the temptation from Potiphar's wife, you know why he was tempted? Because he was so doggone well built and good looking. It's exactly what the text says, coming down to verse 6. So he left everything he owned in Joseph's charge, and with him there he did not concern himself with anything except the food which he ate. Now Joseph was handsome. The Jewish Bible translates that well built. He was well built. He was handsome in form and in appearance. Joseph was good looking and a well built. And I think with that then comes a principle. The physically attractive believer. The physically attractive believer is especially susceptible to sexual temptation. The physically attractive believer is more susceptible to sexual temptation. The implication of the text is Potiphar's wife would have never come on to Joseph if the guy hadn't been so good looking. So we might, if we dare in an age like this that looks at physical appearance and puts such great attention to it, that apparently Joseph, had he been, had just a little more of a pot belly, we're not advocating this, but a little more of a pot belly and maybe had been balding, you know, halfway back and hadn't been so good looking, apparently he would have never faced this type of thing. Not only did Joseph exemplify that, but you can also demonstrate it by Genesis 12:11. And if you happen to be in the good-looking, handsome, well-built category, that's fine. But if you're not, you might want to say, thank you, Lord. At least there's an area. I mean, nobody wants me. Okay, 12:11. The same thing happened with Sarah. Apparently Sarah was one of those very beautiful women. And that is why she was very susceptible to the sexual advances of those in authority. Notice verse 11. Or 10 to get the context. There was a famine in the land, so Abram went down to Egypt to sojourn there, for the famine was severe in the land. And notice we have a very practical problem, and the practical problem comes with a good-looking wife. Came about when he came near to Egypt that he said to Sarah his wife, "See now, I know that you are a beautiful woman." He recognized her physical attractiveness. And it will come about when the Egyptians see you, they will say, "This is his wife," and they will kill me and let you live. And so notice the special problem that rose because of her physical good looks. Chapter 26. We're not advocating ugliness. Someone said, "Beauty is only skin deep, but ugly goes all the way to the bone." But we are trying to face a reality that physical attractiveness carries with it special temptations that are not there otherwise. Chapter 26 and verse 7, another case of the same problem. When the men of the place asked about his wife, he said, "She is my sister." For he was afraid to say, "My wife," thinking, "The men of this place might kill me on account of Rebekah, for she is beautiful." And he's talking about physical beauty in this context. I will never forget the remark S. Lewis Johnson used to make about Bible translations. He said, Bible translations are like beautiful, are like women. If beautiful, not faithful. If faithful, not beautiful. And he was emphasizing that sometimes the beauty of the English text is not really faithful or true to the real, and that was his illustration of it. But you notice you have the same thing here in chapter 26, and in the context of Joseph, you have a physically attractive person. Okay? Fourth observation. Victory in temptation is rooted in a true view of sin. Joseph understood what sin was. We have, in teaching the doctrine of sin, mentioned before that the fundamental issue in sin is God is offended. It's not people, though they are involved in it in a secondary way. The basic root issue in sin is not that I've offended somebody. The root issue is I have offended God. Every man who overcomes temptation and comes to grips with sin views that way. Remember David, in looking at the sin with Bathsheba and the murder of her husband, what does he say in Psalm 51? Against thee and thee only have I sinned. That's a true view of sin. Notice Joseph had that also. Verse 8, as she approaches him day after day, verse 8 says, he refused and said to his master's wife, behold, with me here, my master does not concern himself with anything in the house. He has put all that he owns in my charge. There is no one greater in the house than I. He has withheld nothing from me except you, because you're his wife, and I will not sin against him. Well, that was part of his mentality, but notice the latter part of the verse. How can I do this great evil and sin against God? Notice his theology, his doctrine of sin was thorough. It was rooted in the fact that sin is basically against God. So we can put down then two issues. The secondary issue is betrayal of Potiphar's trust. And that is truly an issue that Joseph brings up in verse 8, that he doesn't worry about anything that he has committed to my care, and I don't want to betray his trust. However, he goes to the roots, and he sees the primary issue is not the betrayal of Potiphar's trust, but the primary issue is the honor of God. And when Joseph completes his statement, that's where he is that the sin is ultimately against God and against God himself. All right? Fifth point, by way of introduction or observations of doctrinal ideas, victory in temptation does not bring immediate reward. Joseph did the right thing and went to jail. Victory in temptation does not bring immediate reward. Joseph went to jail first, and then he got exalted. And what this helps us do then, this ought to help us qualify the idea that God rewards obedience. There's truth to that, isn't it? God rewards obedience. Look at the reward that Joseph got. He was obedient and faithful to God, and he got thrown in jail. So while it is a general truth, God does respond ultimately to the obedience of the believer, we can't lay claim and say that, well, I've obeyed and I expect my reward now. Again, repeat, Joseph was faithful to God and he got himself thrown in jail. Okay, next, and again, we're still looking to... Joseph didn't even get a hearing. You read through the chapter, and we'll go through it in detail on Wednesday. But when you go through the chapter, I mean, Potiphar's wife is believed. His master doesn't ask any questions. He just believes her and throws him in jail. He had no hearing, no justice whatsoever, and yet he was obedient to God. So this ought to modify our expectation. I think we've probably been raised in an era when, among Christians, you've got that foggy idea that obey the Lord And every morning will be sunshine. You will hear music in there all of the time because you've obeyed the Lord. That is not true in this world, and we need to modify that idea. The key idea of chapter, if we look at doctrinal concepts, and now third, Genesis 39 is a success story. Genesis 39 is a success story. And we will find the whole narrative of chapter 39 breaks into three parts around the idea of success. Number one, success in the house of Potiphar. 39, 1 through 6. Second, success in temptation. Verses 7 through 20. Third, success in prison. 21 through 23. And in every case, though the circumstances were ugly, Joseph was successful. He was successful in management. He was successful in his morals. And he was successful in prison all the way through. Now, let me show you something about the structure of Genesis 39. The structure revolves about those three parts. And so let's put it in columns. We'll put 39, 1 through 6 in the first column, and 39, 7 through 20 in the middle column, and then 39, 21 through 23 in the third column. Now the reason I'm drawing it this way on the overhead is this. 39, 1 through 6 and 39, 21 through 23 form a frame in which the temptation fits. In other words, think of a picture. Think of the narrative of Joseph's faithfulness, 39, 7 through 20, and that is all framed. And it's framed by the first and the last section. And notice how these sections in three ways build a frame. First of all, in 39, 1 through 6, you have an emphasis on the Lord's presence. And let's use verse 4. Verse 4 says, Joseph found favor in his sight and became his personal servant. So that's not it. The Lord's presence, where is it? Pardon me, verse 2. Wrong verses here. Verse 2 emphasizes the Lord's presence. Verse 2, and the Lord was with Joseph. That's the beginning in which the temptation is framed. Now, go over to the last section, and notice what matches the Lord's presence in the house. You find the Lord's presence, the matching counterpart to that, in verse 21. But the Lord was with Joseph. Verse 2, the Lord was with Joseph. First section, the Lord was with Joseph in verse 21, the last section. In the first section, he obtained the trust of Potiphar. And that is found in verse 6. So he left, that is Potiphar, left everything he owned in Joseph's charge. He trusted him. The matching part to that in the last section is the trust of the jailer. And that is found in verse 23. Verse 23 in the last section says, the chief jailer did not supervise anything under Joseph's charge because the Lord was with him. So the Lord's presence in section 1 matches the Lord's presence in section 2. The trust of Potiphar in section 1 matches the trust of the jailer in the last part. Third, it says he got grace in the eyes of Potiphar, and that's verse 4. So Joseph found favor in his sight, and grace in the eyes of Potiphar matches grace or favor in the eyes of the jailer. Verse 21. But the Lord was with Joseph and extended kindness to him and gave him favor in the sight of the chief jailer. So notice then the framework in which the temptation fits is the Lord's presence, the trust of Potiphar, and the grace in his eyes, matching the last section, the Lord's presence, the trust of the jailer, and grace in his eyes. This then brings us to the middle part. And we have the first temptation and refusal. Verse 7. Came about after these events that his master's wife looked with desire at Joseph and said, "Lie with me." And now we have, again, there's the temptation. Now we have the refusal. He refused and said to his master's wife, etc., down through verse 9. That is followed by the second temptation and refusal, verses 10 through 12. Came about as she spoke to Joseph day after day, that he did not listen to lie beside her or be with her. Now it happened one day he went to the house to do his work, and none of the men of the household was there inside. She caught him by the garment, saying, "Lie with me." And he left his garment in her hand and fled and went outside. He did what was right. And he ended up in jail because he did what was right. That is followed now by two accusations. The first accusation is in verse 14. She called the men of her household, said to them, "See, he has brought in a Hebrew to us to make sport of us, for he came in to lie with me, and I screamed." And that is a lie, every word of it. The second accusation comes down to verse 17, and it's made to her husband. She spoke to him, her husband, with these words, "The Hebrew slave whom you brought to us came in to me to make sport of me, and it happened as I raised my voice and screamed that he left his garment beside me and fled outside." And that is the structure of the way this chapter is put together. Now, one of the reasons for giving this to you in this way is not only to see the order in which Moses has written, but again to refer you, as we did with the, remember antithetical parallelism. Remember with the Tower of Babel account, with the whole flood account, is structured that way. And it argues against the theory that is propounded today that the Pentateuch was made up over the years by a series of redactors. And the answer to that is looking at the structure that is here in this chapter. Do you think that structure was entered by centuries of redactors who came along and kept that structure intact? No way. The structure argues for one author, a single author, Moses, for the writing of the Pentateuch. Now, we want to pick up in our next study the transitional events of chapter 39 through 41. And what we want to look at is, in these chapters, we want to see the synergeo events. Synergeo, remember, is the verb used in Romans 8:28 that says all things work together for good. And we're going to see an exposition in these three chapters of the verb synergeo, things working together that brought about the exaltation of Joseph and bring him to a place of prominence. And they will be, some of them, good events. Some of them, like this one, will be horrible event. The false accusation transitions Joseph to jail. And would you believe what happened? When he got in jail, chapter 40, verse 1, it came about after these things, the cupbearer and the baker for the king of Egypt offended the Lord, and their Lord, the king, and they got thrown in Joseph, in the jail, and there they met Joseph. And of all things, they had a dream. And of all things, Joseph interpreted. And when he was released, of all things, Pharaoh had a dream. And of all things, the cupbearer remembered about how Joseph interpreted his dream, told Pharaoh about how that happened, and Joseph was then exalted to the place of prime minister in Egypt. And it's a whole series of events, some pleasant, most of them unpleasant, all that are synergeoed together by God to work together for good. And we'll see those transitional events from one place to another in our next study. Father, we're thankful again for your word, and particularly for the life of Joseph, for the way you sovereignly work on behalf of him to bring him to the place that you desire him to be. May we recognize that it really doesn't make any difference what happens to us, because you are in control. And if we can have the kind of attitude that recognize the way you, in your own sovereign manner, work things together for good, may we see this in Christ's name. Amen.